Time to catch up as we do once a month with Dr. Zoe Harker. Morning, Zoe. How are you?
Good morning. Very good, thanks. How are you doing?
So, where do we begin with this? Well, I guess we start by kind of stating the obvious, really, that the thing which has kind of condemned people, particularly who live alone, is to be denied just a single human touch, isn't over the last 12 weeks and still ongoing for some people. We couldn't give our loved ones a hug, even those who were dying. And that was based on this thing which has become known bizarrely as social distancing, but really it's physical distancing. Isn't it?
Yeah, it's a bit antisocial distancing as well, because it is separating us from other human beings. And you're quite right, the people I most feel for are the people who live alone, usually elderly, usually susceptible to loneliness anyway, who for now for 12 weeks and ongoing in Wales, we have had practically no restrictions lifted whatsoever. England is charging ahead at a different pace.
Yeah.
We've got elderly people in the village. The furthest that they've gone in the past few weeks is to sit outside in the garden with somebody a couple of metres away, perhaps a neighbour. They haven't really left the home. And that's what we've condemned people to now for over 3 months. And I think it is having catastrophic consequences. And I think some of those will be felt for some time ongoing.
As we look back at the advice of the World Health Organization, back in February 2020, their advice was avoid close contact with anyone who has fever and a cough. By the end of February, they're advising people maintain at least 1 meter distance between yourself and anyone who is coughing or sneezing. And that remained the advice until they updated it on April the 29th, when it became maintain at least 1 meter distance between yourself and others. Now, the change there from fever and cough to coughing and sneezing and then to anyone, but not until the end of April. And one would assume that they, being the World Health Organization, they weren't just plucking it out of a hat. Or were they?
Oh, you would hope, wouldn't you? I was really interested to find that, actually, that the advice, and I had to go back into archive websites to see how the advice had changed. Avoiding close contact, not being within a metre of somebody who is coughing or sneezing, sounds like pretty sensible advice.
Yeah.
And I think we would be able to look at things like droplet transmission to say that actually that's probably quite sensible advice. But in terms of actual hard evidence, which is what I look at, so when this first came in, so in the UK, for example, we had this 2 meter rule introduced. So we didn't even follow the World Health Organization 1 meter. We introduced this 2 meter rule on March the 16th. I think that 2 meter rule came in for us. And at that time, I went back to look at what we call the systematic review evidence. And all that means is you go through all the evidence systematically, so you don't cherry pick, you just look at everything. And I went back to have a look at that, and I was surprised at just how little information there was. So there was a gold standard report from 2011, one of the Cochrane reports, and that basically concluded that they had found no evidence for spatial separation of at least 1 meter, which is what we would call physical distancing or social distancing.
Mm.
Then there was another systematic review published in 2018, which actually didn't even examine what we're calling social distancing. So this queuing outside shops, staying 2 meters apart from anybody when you walk in a city centre or on the pavement or something. That systematic review didn't even examine that. It looked at things like working patterns, if perhaps people work different shifts, so they actually physically avoided each other entirely, might that help? And a lot of those were modelling exercises anyway, so they weren't real studies.
And obviously not based on COVID-19, but based on what?
On flu,
right.
Basically.
Which is a coronavirus.
So which is not a coronavirus, absolutely not a coronavirus. And that was part of the problem. So the 2011 study looked at respiratory infections in general, and then the one that came out in 2018 looked at flu particularly. There was another one that came out in May after the World Health Organization had changed its advice 3 times. And again, that looked at flu, and it didn't look at what we're calling social distancing. So then along finally came a very, very good report in The Lancet on the 1st of June, and it went through all the studies, and it was particularly important because it only looked at studies for coronaviruses.
Right. Sorry to stop you. I'm a bit confused. So flu is not a coronavirus?
No, flu is not a coronavirus. So we have a number of different respiratory infections, common cold, as we would call them, influenza. And then there are particular viruses that we put into a category called coronaviruses.
Yep.
And the reason we call them that is when you look at these viruses under the microscope, they look like crowns.
Yes.
So pictorially, they look like crowns. So we call them coronavirus from the Latin word for crown. So one of the first coronaviruses that people will have heard of was SARS, the first SARS.
Right.
So that was actually called SARS-CoV, coronavirus 1. And what we've got at the moment is SARS-CoV-2.
Ah.
So it's similar to that first SARS, but different. And then we had another one in between. We had one called MERS,
yep.
Which was the Middle Eastern respiratory syndrome. And that one was particularly, it caused particularly high mortality, was particularly virulent. But thankfully, SARS-1 and MERS just kind of almost snuffed themselves out, SARS-1 particularly. MERS is still around, and I think it's transmitted from camels to humans, particularly in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, other places like that. So you probably shouldn't drink raw camel milk. But I happen to have been in Saudi Arabia last year,
right.
And I can tell you they still drink raw camel milk.
Blimey.
So they're not so worried about it. But this Lancet paper was really good because it actually looked at the evidence that we had around the transmission of those coronaviruses.
Okay.
And it managed to have a couple of papers that were devoted to looking at MERS, 4 that were looking at the first SARS, and then 3 that were actually looking at what we're facing, which is COVID-19.
Got it.
Now, when I went through the paper and I said, okay, I'm going to eliminate all of them, all of those studies that are in healthcare settings, in hospitals, and many of those were where people were wearing masks that looked like something out of the war. Imagine a heavy-duty gas mask. It's like, okay, those need to go because that's not going to help us in understanding, do we need to stay 2 meters apart outside the grocery store?
Yeah.
And then you're left with 9 studies. And one of those was on a plane, which was quite interesting. And it showed that when somebody was infected with a coronavirus on a plane, then the people most likely to catch it were the people in the rows near that person.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not a surprise.
No.
But the other 8 studies were not studying the standing outside the grocery store. So they were what we call household transmission studies. So it's track and trace.
Yep.
So you get the virus, and then they track and trace you. Who do you pass the virus to? And basically, all 8 concluded that you are most likely to pass the virus to your closest contact.
Mm-hmm.
So your spouse, your partner, anyone who shares a bedroom with you if you live in a dormitory, your main carer if you're somebody who needed care while you had the virus. Those were the people who got the virus. And in many of the studies, exclusively those were the people who got the virus.
Which makes kind of sense, because in terms of volume of air you're breathing over them, because you're with them all the time, it makes total sense.
Totally. And you're back to that coughing and sputtering all over them, which is also what has been happening to our healthcare workers. Why have so many healthcare workers caught the virus and also caught it so badly? Because not only have they had people coughing and spluttering all over them, that also means they get a higher viral load, which we now know is an issue as well. It's much better if you just touch the virus on a handrail and then touch your face a couple of hours later. That's a low dose.
Mm.
If you're in accident and emergency and somebody is coughing and spluttering all over you as you're trying to turn them over or putting them on a machine, then you're in big trouble. So,
absolutely.
I mean, one of the studies actually concluded casual contact and simple proximity were not associated with transmission. Your chance of standing outside the grocery store and catching it from the person next to you is just so low. And as for this, why have some countries gone for 2 meters? What are the? I'm just trying to see.
Oh, we're going down now. We've decided to make it even more complicated. We've gone from 2 meters and we're about to go to 1.5. So we all like to carry a tape measure now. Yeah.
So you're now with Australia, Germany, and the Netherlands. They went for 1.5 meters.
I don't know about you, but I don't know what 1.5 meters is. But where are we?
I'm actually just over 1.5 meters.
Oh, bless
tall,
you!
So
oh, bless!
It's just lie down and then stand up at where my feet were, next to where the other person's feet were, and then I'd be okay.
So the Spanish have to stay a Zoe Harkham away from each other. There we are.
Zoe Harkham, yeah, as opposed to a Peter Crouch.
Superb! Love it.
Or probably a Bill. You might be nearer 2 meters.
Oh, dear, that's funny. In terms of one of the other rules, which is about to occur here as we enter what everyone hatefully is calling the new normal, which isn't normal at all, it is that the Spanish are saying that if you cannot maintain your social distance of 1.5 metres, then you must wear a mask. This is now mandatory, which will carry a €100 fine. So, for example, anyone who goes in the supermarket and doesn't wear a mask will be told to wear one or be fined €100. And if you can't socially distance in any other circumstance, except, of course, when you go to a bar, when you can quite happily sit around in the bar or get drunk and have no masks on, or you can have go to a restaurant because, of course, the virus knows exactly that it mustn't attack you because you're having fun rather than doing your shopping, because it's very discerning.
And you're eating then. Your mouth is open. I mean,
absolutely.
That's probably one of the higher transmission chances.
Now, you also looked into masks, didn't you, Zoe?
I did a long time ago, and the research question that I asked is, do masks help?
Yeah.
And again, it went back to that 2011 Cochrane review. That whole Cochrane review was on different interventions to prevent the transmission of respiratory viruses. Again, it wasn't COVID-19. We didn't have that then.
Yeah.
And one of the interventions that was looked at was masks, and there were some studies in healthcare settings, and there were some studies out in the sort of public environment. And the research question, do masks help? The answer to that is yes. They do reduce the risk of transmission. I think it was something like 16 from memory, mm-hmm. 69 in 100 if you weren't wearing a mask, to 39, let's say, in 100 if you were wearing a mask. So yes, they help.
Of transmission as opposed to of catching
transmission.
It.
Yes. Yeah, of transmission. But you've then got a whole load of other caveats of, do people wear their masks properly? I mean, I've seen people on the television being interviewed, and they've just pulled their mask down to their chin.
Absolutely.
And then they're about to pull their mask back up onto their face. It's like, okay, so your chin might have been contaminated, but your mask might have been clean. So there's lots of issues, and there's people who've got asthma who then can't breathe properly. There's people with claustrophobia and anxiety who then have panic attacks. And
well, you see, I didn't think I had any of those until I went to the supermarket wearing a mask. And it just turned into a horror film for me, because I felt all of those things, claustrophobic, anxious, really, really hot, couldn't breathe properly. My glasses steamed up and fell on the floor, then nearly stood on my glasses, And I thought, I'm feeling a bit lightheaded here. And I thought, well, that doesn't make, it doesn't, I'm not surprised, because am I not breathing in my own carbon dioxide?
Yeah, pretty much. You're not breathing. I mean, it depends on the type of the mask. If you've got a surgical one that's properly designed, but you can't get those for love nor money at the moment because of the price. And you don't want to be getting those anyway, because the healthcare workers need them.
Yeah.
So then people have been doing these videos online, and people have been using socks. I mean, how can you breathe through a pair of cotton socks even, let alone woolly socks? And some people have been putting them double layer because they think it gives them extra protection. And then you're right, you're not breathing in fresh air. And where you live, that's even more important, because you're in a hot, humid environment anyway.
Yes.
And you are going to maybe overheat, as you say, get a bit faint, a bit dehydrated, because you don't take your mask off to take a drink of water, because you know you're not supposed to touch your mask until you get home and do it all safely and all that kind of thing. So this is just going nuts. This is the fear that we have put into people. And most people do not need to be fearful of this. And
yes. Oh, have we lost her? Oh, I think we may have lost Zoe, actually. Let's try calling her back. This is what you call, this call radio by the seat of the pants here. Let's try calling her back live on air. So you seem to have lost her there. So give it a bash.
You've been messing with your buttons again.
No, it wasn't me that time. No, not guilty. That's because you ran out of oxygen, because you were talking about carbon dioxide and you're wearing a mask.
I think so, yeah. No, I'm not wearing a mask. But I mean, young, healthy, fit, non-risk people, don't need to be. I mean, they really don't. And the World Health Organization came out recently and said, you know, we're not even sure if someone's asymptomatic, if they can even transmit this thing.
Yes.
So we're back to that coughing, spluttering person again. And if you're coughing and spluttering, you should be at home.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be in a supermarket wearing a mask or not wearing a mask. Just stay at home. We've already got a rule on that one.
Absolutely.
Which is actually quite a sensible rule. And then all the other rules are a little bit not so sensible in my view.
And what about the people who are kind of, I've had an email, in fact, a WhatsApp from Denise in El Palo, who says, I've been tested for antibodies and have apparently had COVID-19. My husband tested negative. That's an interesting one, isn't it? Because, of course, just because you had COVID-19 or you were negative for COVID-19 and now have antibodies for it, that doesn't mean you can't get it again, does it?
Well, we don't know that. So in every other virus, when you've developed antibodies to it, you have a degree of immunity. It's
right.
Not always forever. And particularly with the flu virus, because a different one comes along every year. So you might have antibodies to last year's flu virus, but you might well get this year's flu virus because it has changed. So we don't know enough about this yet to know if it's going to mutate to the point that we're no longer immune, or if people who have had it will have at least a certain degree of immunity for life or for a year or for a period of time. We don't know. What is really interesting, I was chatting to one of my NHS worker friends who's actually taking part in the UK vaccine trial at the moment, which is very interesting, and she said that she has a number of colleagues who tested positive for the virus because they were testing NHS workers more than anyone else in the UK, and they're now trying antibody tests out on them, and they're all testing negative.
Oh, how interesting.
So they know they've had the virus, but they are not testing on the antibody test. So there is still a lot we don't know about this thing.
Well, there's an interesting article today. I must send you this, because you probably haven't seen it. And this is from a Spanish COVID-19 expert who's called Margarita Del Val, who's a virologist and immunologist. And she's coordinating an initiative by the Spanish National Research Council. And she is basically saying in an interview that there is a lot of virus in Spain currently in circulation, more than before the state of alarm. It is difficult to provide an estimate, but there is more of it now. Let's see if the health ministry stabilizes its figures, but there are more outbreaks now. So that's a very interesting statement to make, isn't it?
It is, and it might have weakened. I mean, the most positive news we ever have is that SARS-1 just snuffed itself out.
Yeah.
So SARS-1 didn't travel too far around the world. It did get as far as Canada, and it was found in South Korea, and it originated over in that region of the world. But by 2003, the summer, it had just snuffed out.
Mm.
And we don't have any cases of SARS-1 across the world at the moment. Now,
right. It
would be fabulous if this did the same. I'm not saying that it would, because this has now become a pandemic.
And we've had flare-ups, haven't we, Zoe? If you look at Beijing, for example, they have allegedly now got it, and they're blaming it on the Europeans this time. It's tit for tat, I think.
Yeah, they might have given it to us, and we might have given it back. But what is going to be interesting is it weakening? Because you do know when you study virology that they're always looking for the host. If you look at the movies like Contagion and Outbreak, they're trying to find the host, whether it was an animal or a human, whoever was the original source of the virus, they want to find that person, because that's actually your best chance of finding a vaccine or a cure or understanding the virus. And inevitably, as it then transmits to someone else, it's kind of like diluting, pouring vinegar in a bucket and then spreading the bucket into other buckets. It changes, it mutates, it can get stronger, it can get weaker, but it can change. And we won't know how this one has changed until we're able to look back on it in a few months' time, maybe a year's time, to say, crikey, look what happened, and look what happened. And it might happen differently in Spain to South Korea.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in different people to other people. So there's so much still to learn about this. We just got to stay open-minded and keep doing research and keep reading and not shutting down opinions, because there is a bit of that going on the internet.
Absolutely.
And that's as dangerous as anything, because who's to say that somebody, you know, the first person that said, well, actually, I don't think the world is flat, you know, they were just about burned at the stake, but actually turned out to be right. So unless you've got some really stupid conspiracy theories, fine, get those to one side.
Yeah.
But if anyone is saying, I mean, who would have thought, hey, I wonder if that steroid could help people who are on ventilators in intensive care. And look what happened yesterday, the publication of a trial where exactly that happened. It's shown to have a significant improvement. If you end up on a ventilator in ICU and you take this particular steroid, you had a 30% reduced chance of dying from COVID. I mean, who would have thought that?
Absolutely. No, good. Very sensible talk, Zoe. And talking of people people dying, you were given a very interesting survey to take part in. And it was really about your actions and whether you thought that those actions had been right in the country, how you changed your behaviour. But there was one particular question in the patient A and B section, which was, talk about matter of life and death.
Well, this was so interesting. This was totally out of the blue. So I got an email saying, we've picked up your email address because you've been published in a high impact factor journal over the very recent years, and therefore we'd like to invite you to participate in this survey. So I imagine they've written that to hundreds of email addresses that they've picked up from the scientific literature, and then we would have to say you're a researcher or you're a medical doctor, and perhaps you published a case study. So they would know a lot about us.
Yeah.
And then they started asking us questions about our government's response. This is obviously a global survey, and they'll be able to come up with things such as 80% of researchers in Spain thought their government had done a good job versus 30% in the UK or something. So I can't wait for the paper to come out. But they got into what we call moral judgments in this particular section between two patients. So they'd say, here's the scenario. You're the manager at the local hospital. You are in charge of the whole proceedings. There are two patients who arrive at the same time, and you've got one ICU bed left, and they both need that ICU bed. And choose between the two patients. And the various scenarios we were given, so the first one was you've got a male aged 55 and then a female aged 55, so they're asking you to choose on sex. Then you've got a male aged 75 and a male aged 55, so they're asking you to choose on age. Then you've got somebody with a pre-existing condition and somebody without a pre-existing condition, so they're asking you to choose. Essentially what they were looking at, I mean, you could see in all the cases that patient B, or in the cases where one had a better prognosis than the other, it was the patient B. So at one level, you could say that there was a right answer, that you had a greater chance of the younger male surviving than the older male.
Right.
You had a greater chance of the female surviving than the male, and you've got a greater chance of the person without existing conditions surviving rather than a person with pre-existing conditions. But who on earth wants to make that choice at the point that they both arrive at hospital? And yet, by all accounts, that is exactly what happened in Lombardy in Italy at the height of their crisis.
Goodness me. And of course, if you don't make the choice, I guess someone else will make it for you, Zoe.
Well, that's it, and that was the scenario. So you had an option to say, I decline to answer this question, but then they gave you the outcome that if you do that, given that you are the hospital manager, you've now got to waste time for somebody else to be found.
Yeah.
And in that time that is wasted, you might deteriorate both patients, because they're both sat in the waiting area wondering which one's going to end up on the ICU bed.
Wow.
But then it got bigger, and they started saying, okay, so if an intervention could reduce COVID deaths by 10,000 but would increase other deaths by 10,000, which is the lockdown big question, if you reduce deaths from the virus but you increase deaths from, say, cancer,
yes,
by exactly the same amount, which would you do?
Well, that's a real question right now, isn't it? Because lots of people have been scared to go to get out, or not getting their treatment. It's not been available to them, some people who are kind of terminally ill with cancer or have major heart issues.
Well, in the UK alone, it's been estimated that there were 120,000 fewer cancer referrals in April alone.
My goodness.
And they know that many of those would have been referrals that then would have required biopsies and scans, and in some cases people would have been operated on very, very quickly. We have already had cases where operations were cancelled at the end of March, so our lockdown was announced 23rd of March. There was somebody who had an operation due on the 30th of March, father of four with cancer, and he died during lockdown because his operable cancer became inoperable and things got bad really, really fast.
Oh, dear.
And that is utterly tragic. And if we come back and say, okay, so there was one of those, and then we think what we did saved 10,000 people from COVID, then okay, we made a good decision. But if it's 10,000 versus 10,000,
yeah,
and it might be 10,000 at an average age of 80 versus 10,000 at an average age of 50, or what the survey again said is don't just look at your own country, but they're estimating now that the poverty outcome of this, because of all of our economies shrinking, we could put 500 million people around the world into poverty.
Yeah.
We could kill up to 1 million children and pregnant women, because those are the ones who suffer most when economies crash and they don't have access to healthcare in their own countries.
Goodness me.
Yeah, do we factor that in? Maybe we should.
Well, both of those things we've discussed are on your website, zoeharcombe.com. Fantastic to talk to you as always, Zoe. Before you go, and you mentioned that The Lancet earlier, there's a book which is out tomorrow called The COVID-19 Catastrophe. What's gone wrong and how to stop it happening again? And the guy who's written it is Richard Horton, who's the editor of The Lancet. And he's a guest on my show in about 2 weeks' time to talk about that book. So next time we speak, I will know a bit more about what went on from the Lancet's point of view, which will be interesting.
Very interesting. I look forward to that one.
Brilliant. And I will send you the article of the Spanish COVID expert who's saying there's more virus circulating now than there was before the state of alarm. That might be interesting to you as well. ZoeHarcombe.com, the website.
So
yeah, thank you, Zoe. I'll keep hold of my buttons next time and make sure they don't run loose on my mixing desk. You take care of yourself.
Fabulous.
All the best.
Keep
bye-bye.
You soon.
Bye-bye.